Yeah, baby. It's episode 137 of Ask the Inspector on February 20th, 2024. Jeff Norman with Scott Ritter on Tuesday. That means it's the lightning round. Scott answers every question in 3 minutes or less. And once again, we'll be giving away a coin. The winner will have his or her choice. This is the coin that Scott gave away when he visited Russia last May. And when he returned in January, this is the coin he gave away. So again, whomever wins can have their choice of which coin they want. And to enter the drawing, which we'll do at the end of the show, type in hashtag coin in the live chat. That's hashtag coin. Scott is joined by his head of security, Maverick, having just completed a very lengthy, extensive first part of a two-part article about Volovny. Let me say that again, Volovny. And part one is called Origins, which goes into a lot of his background as somewhat of a political activist. And before we get to our first question, Scott, what would you like to say to whet the appetite of our beloved audience so that they rush to Substack to read it at scottritterextra.com, which Yelena might be good enough to flash on the screen for us.
As you said, it's a two-part series. Look, I've been saying all along, anybody who's been following me on Twitter, I've been saying that Navalny is a traitor to Russia. And that's why the article is, at first, the original article was the death of a traitor. And I have no sympathy for this guy whatsoever, until I started researching in more depth and digging deeper. And this is an article I told Jeff, Friday night? I said, Jeff, I got it for you. I'll get it for you for the weekend. We got this.
That's right. Yeah.
And I stayed up, and next thing I know, it's like 1 a.m. on Friday. And I'm going, I ain't even close, because every time I thought I had it, I found something new, and I dug deeper and I went, wow. And basically I had to change the title to The Tragic Death. And the reason why it's a tragic death is he's still a traitor. I mean, let there be no doubt. Alexei Navalny worked on behalf of the CIA and British intelligence to try to undermine the Russian government, to remove Vladimir Putin from office, not as a part of the pressure from the Russian people, not as part of a democratic movement, but to meet the policy objectives of the United States. In this article, you'll see how the first, because he did this three times. Alexei Navalny was involved in three regime change attempts. And this article talks about the regime change attempt that took place in 2007, 2008. It's a interesting time. Not too many non-Russians realize what was happening then, but that was the period of time when Vladimir Putin's constitutionally mandated term in office ended. He could only do two consecutive terms, but he believed that there was still problems that needed to be solved, and he was right. But how to do this? So they came up with, at that time, Dmitry Medvedev was the prime minister. So they came up with a nifty little power swap deal where the United Russia Party would, make a run for the parliamentary elections and for the Duma in December of 2007. And if they won, then Vladimir Putin would accept their, because he never really joined the United Russia Party. He's never, at least back then he wasn't. But he would accept the position of prime minister if he was put forward. Dmitry Medvedev then would have to run for president, again, United Russia. And this all depended, then he'd have to win the presidency because the president appoints the prime minister. So there were two things that had to happen. United Russia needed to win the parliament, the Duma election, and then Medvedev needed to win the presidency. And the United States and Great Britain said this is a moment of vulnerability for Putin and Medvedev, that if we can get the Russian people to rise up and have democracy make its voice heard, that one, we can stop United Russia from winning the parliament, and in doing so you kill the momentum of United Russia. Now you Medvedev wasn't that popular of a figure at that time, and you could beat it, and you could sweep Putin out of office. That was the goal. That was the objective. And people can say, well, that's pretty naive. And today it looks like it might have. But remember, they're coming off on the hills of three successful color revolutions. The first in Serbia that ousted Milosevic. The second in Georgia that ousted Shevardnadze. And the third in Ukraine in 2004 that ousted Viktor Yanukovych and put in a nationalist leader. The one in Ukraine depended on a youth movement, this is where Navalny came in, because Navalny was this hotshot lawyer who, was trying to, wasn't even that much of a hotshot lawyer. He was a young lawyer, we'll call him, but he was dabbling in politics. He got involved in the Yabloko, the Apple movement, but he was in his core, he's a nationalist. He got tangled up with this journalist Albats, who has a murky past in Harvard. She has connections with probably the CIA, at least the State Department. She came from her Harvard PhD program, and then she opened up this parlor in her apartment immediately, a political silence parlor, where she brought in people like Garry Kasparov and Maria Gaidar, the daughter of the former prime minister, and Alexei Navalny and others, to talk about politics, to create this momentum, to get this youth movement going. They had the dissenters march, thousands of people in the streets. It looked like there was stuff happening. It failed at the end. They got crushed at the polls. United Russia won. Medvedev won the presidency, and they got crushed. To bring this up, you have to understand who Navalny is. You have to know that he was part of this movement, and that this movement was paid for by the United States, paid for by British intelligence. I talk in there about about the intelligence rock, in case people say, "Scott, you got nothing to go on." Well, there was the intelligence rock. The intelligence rock, of course, being this rock that was hollowed out and had this communication gear in it, and basically, it was designed by the British together with the CIA. They never talk about that, but the Russians know. You want to know why they know? Because they got the rock, and they got all the stuff in the rock, and they know what it is. But basically, so you didn't have to do the old school meeting with somebody, because that was pretty risky. The Russians were rolling up CIA networks and British networks. You put the rock in place, and you get these guys little BlackBerry-type devices. And so they'll walk by the rock. They get within, I think, 20 meters of it, and you get a connection. And then you download your information on a rock. And then the British walk by, and they go, oh, somebody downloaded something. And they upload it, and you don't ever have to meet. And the Russians were, of course, following this British guy, one of their agents, as they are wont to do, because they knew who he was. And he's walking around, but he's not meeting anybody. And the Russians are getting a little curious. They're like, why isn't he meeting anybody? And they see him go by the rock. You see, he walked by the rock 20 meters, and he didn't get a signal. And so he walks by it again, didn't get a signal. Now the Russians are going, something's interesting. Then he starts kicking the rock. The Marine Corps method. When something doesn't work, pound it and to see if you get it up. And then, he got the signal, and he did it, and he walked away. And the Russians went, that's strange. So they went to the rock and they looked at it. They said, oh, it's not a rock. It's something else. So they monitored that. They went and they found other rock-like devices. But the bottom line is they ended up grabbing that rock. When they went through all the messages that are in the rock, though, it wasn't just spying. They arrested a guy from the Ministry of Defense Industry who was downloading secret documents about Russian defense industry. That's standard spying. Yay, good job. But what they found was, one guy in particular, the guy that managed the British government's non-governmental organization funding, which is legitimate. The Foreign Office has a website. These people apply for grants and they distribute the money. The guy that does that was sending covert messages to non-governmental organizations, Human Rights Watch and others, who were receiving black money. Because the British government has the white money. This is what we're giving them. This is what's declared. And that's what the Russians follow. They say, okay, that contract went to this. But there was the black money that was being given to them as well, which they would use for the stuff that they're trying to hide from the Russian government. And the British were caught dead. And the Russians took a look at that and went, all right, we're passing a law. NGOs can't take foreign money. They're undesirable. Boom. And it helped break the back of this movement. But you know, Navalny was caught up in all this. And then I talk about what happened after that election. He, you know, he starts this anti-corruption thing. It's pretty successful because after the election, it's interesting. Dmitry Medvedev is the anti-corruption president. And a lot of what Medvedev was doing was, you know, going against Putin cronies. And the West is like, wow, we weren't expecting this. And neither was Navalny, because he starts taking on Rosneft, Gazprom, and others. Rosneft, of course, Sechin, Putin's left-hand man or right-hand man, runs it. He's taking that on. Medvedev's going, okay, that's, you can do this. So you know, he's doing this, but he runs out of money because he's not, at this point in time, he's not funded by the West. He's not even really on the Western radar yet. That's the, you know, Kasparov was and others, Nemtsov. But he gets a phone call from a guy who he knew in Moscow, one of these political opposition figures. But when Medvedev came in, he co-opted him, brought him in, said, I want you to be the governor of Kirov region. Gets a phone call and he says, hey, I need you to come in and help me with some of this corruption stuff. So Navalny needs the money. Off he goes to Kirov. And he gets caught up in something called the Kirov Les. Les is forest. Kirov Les is a lumber company. I won't get into too much detail, but he basically sets them up because people, there's 36 lumber mills and they're cutting timber and selling things on the side, as people are wont to do when they're corrupt. Rather than report it to the big company who then sends it to their stores, they're going, yeah, you want us to cut up these trees, lumber, pay me on the side, boom, boom, direct sale, boom. And the big company's not getting any money and they're losing money. So Navalny meets with the director and says, the way to stop this is to get an official middleman. And I have a friend over here who will set up a middleman company, him, me and I together, and you're going to give us a deal on the lumber. Then we're going to sell the lumber. And we're going to take a 7% commission, but at least now the lumber's on the books and you'll start making a profit. And the director goes, good idea. And it goes on and on. And then here's where it gets fishy, because Navalny does this, but then he runs an audit on the guy and the guy fails the audit and he's fired. And then the whole thing shuts down. Navalny finishes work in September and goes back to Moscow. And you're just sitting there going, none of this makes any sense, but it happened. I think it was a quick way for Navalny to put money in his pocket because he was dead ass broke. He goes back to Moscow. He starts doing his stuff again, but now he gets tapped to go to Yale. Maria Gaidar, the activist, she also, this is again very suspicious. When the governor of Kirov went there, all the activists went, you betrayed us. You sold out to the opposition. You're not part of them. You're ugly. Boo. Well, first phone call goes to Navalny and says, hey, come help me. And he goes, sure. And he goes, second phone call goes to Maria Gaidar. Remember the activist who condemned this guy, Beltic. And she goes, yeah, what do you want me to do? I want you to be deputy governor. So she goes off to be deputy governor. And we're not even at the Skripals, pal. But the bottom line is Navalny comes back and suddenly he's got the seal of approval. Maria Gaidar, who does have connectivity, she is in a cable leaked by WikiLeaks meeting with U.S. embassy officials talking about how she receives money from the National Endowment for Democracy, but she can't admit it because that would be bad. She's part of the conduit of money. She's dirty. She's CIA. She's bad. And she goes to Navalny, why don't you apply to the Yale Fellowship Program? And he goes, what's that? She goes, it's a good deal. You might want to apply for that. So then he goes and suddenly he has friends in high places. The head of the new economic college says, I'll sponsor you. And then Albots, the CIA person, goes, I'll write you a letter of recommendation and I'll make phone calls back to Yale to make it happen. And suddenly everybody's lining up to take this guy who's a nobody, who was such a nobody. He had to go off and run a scheme in Kirov to make enough money to pay his bills. He comes back and suddenly he's blessed and he gets accepted to the Yale program. And off he goes. And that's where the article ends. He's going to Yale. But let me give you a hint. Waiting for him at Yale is the CIA. And he's going to become one of us. And that's part two. Part two is going to walk through the corruption of Navalny and how he gets used, how he becomes a major tool of the CIA to prevent Vladimir Putin from regaining the presidency in 2012. And then to try to disrupt the constitutional reforms in 2021. People ask, why was Navalny arrested? Why was he prosecuted? Well, it was corruption. That's why I talked about Kirov, because that's the big case to put him in jail, what he did with the lumber up there. People say, well, that's politically motivated. Probably. But why was it politically motivated? Because he came back and immediately started doing the U.S. government's work. He's a CIA asset. He worked with the British intelligence, and we're going to get into that part two. But since I've already talked about it, I'll mention this. Part two is going to have it's going to start. I've already written the beginning of part two. McFaul was definitely involved. McFaul groomed him. I'll get to McFaul in a minute. Part two begins with a transcript from The Godfather. Godfather 2, actually. And I've tweeted this. It's Frankie Five Angels. Frankie Five Angels, a member of the Corleone family who betrayed them. And he's going to testify against Michael Corleone in trial, but they bring in his Sicilian brother who stares at them, and he breaks down. So he stops it, but now he's betrayed. Something has to happen. So Tom, the consigliere of Michael Corleone, goes and talks to Frankie. And in the end, it's Frankie said, they talk about the Roman background of the mafia. You know, it's a regime, they're capos, they're soldiers. And he said, and Tom says, you know, when they plotted against this, when people plotted against Caesar and they failed, you know, they took their own lives and their families were saved. And Frankie's like, yeah. So, if I take my own life, my family will be okay. He said, you have nothing to worry about, Frankie. And Frankie ended up slitting his wrists and dying. Now it's a movie, but, how many people know that Navalny's lawyer and his wife were at the prison on February 14th, Valentine's Day, and provided him with medicine and gifts? He immediately goes to Munich, where she's standing by, anticipating something, his death. Frankie Five Angels, you got nothing to worry about. And the part two is going to be all about how Navalny became Frankie Five Angels.
Oh, my God. I can hardly wait. When is this coming out, Scott?
Well, I can't give you a date because...
All right.
I mean, I've done the research, but like I said, I'm such
a... All right, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it.
I want to get it out before we talk about on Friday. I want to get out before Friday's show.
All right. That's my goal. It's a goal. As you're talking about Yale, you know, I'm from New Haven, and as a young boy, my daddy and my grandpa used to take me to see the basketball games and the football games and so forth. It turns out that it's not all so innocent and wholesome at Yale. It's shattering my young boy's image.
Look, George W. Bush, Herbert Walker Bush, I'm sorry. Well, W. went there too.
Oh, yeah, and Skull and Bones, right?
Skull and Bones. Look, the whole, but Yale was... There's books written about it. Harvard and Yale, but especially Yale, was the recruiting ground, prime recruiting ground of the OSS, and then the early days of the CIA. They recruited almost exclusively from Yale secret societies. There's an interesting movie with Matt Damon and Robert De Niro called The Good Shepherd, and it's loosely based upon a CIA officer, Angleton, his life and experiences. But you see in there, they run you through the whole, you know, college secret society and the link between that and between Yale and the CIA. It's real. It's not fake. Now, it's been diminished somewhat nowadays, the CIA's, you know, but the bottom line is that there's an organization, the CIA, called the National Resources Division. And it's actually one of the largest divisions of the CIA's covert arms, the clandestine service. Some people say, well, wait a minute, isn't the CIA not supposed to spy in America? Not on Americans. But the National Resources Division, here's the thing. It's an interesting day, especially after 9-11. After 9-11, the CIA got a lot of money, and they started recruiting these case officers. But now to go overseas, generally speaking, you get put in an embassy under diplomatic cover. And you might have 5-6 slots associated. But now the CIA is going, we want to double the number. And the State Department saying, pound sand. Those are for real diplomats, not for you fake guys. Plus, the good intelligence services know exactly who these people are. And if you're trying to sneak somebody in that they don't know, and you suddenly double the numbers, and they come in from, you know, they're trying to go through their background going, well, where did they take the Foreign Service exam? They just suddenly show up. You know, the cover story is not too good. They'd all be blown anyways. And so then they have to create non-official covers. Remember Evan Gershowitz, we talked about him, the Wall Street Journal, non-official covers, CIA spook, That's what he is. But yet that takes time to create, and it takes a lot of training. So you have all these guys waiting to become real spies. And where do they put them? National Resources Division. And what does the National Resource Division do? Two things. One, they voluntarily debrief businessmen who travel abroad. American businessmen get into countries that the CIA normally can't. Give you an example, back in the 90s, there were American businessmen going to Syria all the time, working with the oil companies. But Syria was sort of a denied place for the CIA, tough to get in. So the CIA would love to debrief these guys. They'd come back, they'd sit down, debrief them about who they met. They'd get all the reports they want. And on occasion, the guy would create a non-official cover slot for somebody to slide in and go in and do stuff. So that's what the National Resources Division. The second thing they do is they hang around universities for these fellowships, and they groom these people and they recruit these people. You'll see in the article, I named the groomer because he's so obvious. You got the fellow, the class of 2010, and you go in there and this one guy, and you read his resume, and it says he used to work for the Office of National Intelligence. He used to, and I'm going, oh, and why is he with the fellow? Because he's a groomer. His job isn't to recruit. No, his job is to spot, to talk, and then get the meeting. He's the guy that says, hey, Alexei, what you doing Thursday night? Why don't we go out for drinks? I'd like you to meet somebody. By the way, Oleg, your buddy from the professor from the economics department is going to be there too. And Alexei's going, oh, well, if the economics professor's there, it can't be a big deal. And he shows up and there's this interesting guy and they just start talking. Hey, what are you doing? You do a blog. Wow. What kind of blogging you do? Really? You're exposing corruption. Are you still doing it? When are you going to start again? Because this is what happened. While Navalny's at Yale, he starts releasing the documents attacking one of the major oil companies in an effort to bring down Putin's reputation. It's released while he's at Yale, and then he arrives back in Russia, and suddenly he's got all the support he wants. Money, he can hire staff, he hires lawyers, and he's got infrastructure because he's the CIA's boy. National Resources Division did it. They do it all over the country. They hold seminars. I can guarantee you, if you live in America and you have a, let's say you have a medical school and they're going to have an international seminar, CIA money's involved, guaranteed, because that's what they do. Their job is to bring in people. Now, 99 of the people they bring in are going to be legitimate because that's good cover, but they're going to bring that one guy that they want to recruit. So they create an entire conference. They bring people in. It's a legitimate conference. But they're just getting that one guy to come in that they can begin to assess and recruit and all this stuff. This is what the National Resources Division, that's your U.S. taxpayer dollars at work, ladies and gentlemen.
Did you see the interview Tucker Carlson did with Mike Betts, the former State Department official? Are you familiar with Mike Betts?
I am, but I didn't see the...
They were talking about how got into some of this, how the CIA works on all these different levels. They had their tentacles everywhere. It was very interesting. All right, why don't we get to the questions? The first one is from Heidi Bear in Santo Domingo, Ecuador. Given Donald Trump's policies towards Israel during his first term as president, moving the U.S. embassy, for example, to Jerusalem in clear violation of U.N. policy, what do you expect in a new Trump presidency, if he were to win, regarding U.S. foreign policy towards Israel? You have 3 minutes to answer that question.
Trump would be 100% behind Israel. He would give Israel all the weapons he needs, all the diplomatic cover it needs. He would be Biden on steroids. There would be no phone calls condemning Israel. He'd be 100% supportive of the settlements. And he'd also view this as an opportunity to take on Iran. Remember, Donald Trump's the man who killed Qasem Soleimani, assassinated him. Donald Trump's the guy that pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal. Donald Trump's the guy that was seeking regime change in Iran, wanted to bomb Iran. This would be a perfect opportunity for him. He would do everything he can. He'd probably even get American troops directly involved in taking down Hamas and Hezbollah and all. He'd get us in a major Middle Eastern war because Donald Trump is 100% in the pocket of Israel.
The next question is from Mr. Anderson in Sweden. I wish to travel to Russia, but the Swedish government forbids insurance companies from issuing travel insurance, which is a prerequisite for the visa. Although they didn't ban me directly, they made it impossible. How did you make it? Any hints? And before you answer this question, Scott, I got an update from Mr. Anderson today. He said he did manage to get insurance from an Armenian company, but maybe you would like to address this question that in a way that might be helpful for somebody else who wants to travel there and would have to go through the same thing.
Well, you need insurance. I mean, it's listed on the visa application form. I fortunately have insurance. The United States has not blocked my insurance company from working. But let's just say, for instance, if they came up and they said Blue Cross Blue Shield says, no, we're not going to operate we're not going to do this in Russia. We're not going to respect that. Then you buy travel insurance and you find a vendor that will offer travel insurance. And this gentleman got the answer, got it from Armenia. It's going to cost you more. But you buy a short-term travel insurance policy and that answers the question right there.
Yeah. It wasn't easy for him. He sent me a few emails and, he had to try a bunch of different companies in different countries until he finally got something from Armenia.
I think another place, Scott is wrong a lot, but it's okay. All right. my wife would concur with that. And so would Maverick and everybody else. But I think Kazakhstan would do it. Georgia could be an option since they just opened up travel. Just find a country where there's regular travel to and from. Even Turkey. Again, Turks go there. But, in the Middle East, Dubai and all that. Any country that regularly has people flying in and out of Russia will probably have some sort of travel insurance broker.
All right. We have a voicemail message from a gentleman named Jasper about Chinese migrants entering the U.S.
Hey, Scott. So there has been a pretty heated up discussion about border invasions in the southern border of the U.S. And there is this growing conspiracy, maybe it's not. A large population of that actually come from China, and it might even be organized or conspired by Chinese government. And lately, Tucker Carlson and Brett Weinstein even did almost exclusive conversation about this. And I think Brett's perspective is pretty clear that there is a huge degree of suspicion that it is actually some sort of invasion organized by supposedly Chinese government, although that's not his conclusion. So I just want to ask what your perspective on this is.
Well, first of all, let me just look at the broader picture of immigration and stuff. I start off with the premise that America is a nation of immigrants. My wife is an immigrant. Both my families on both sides were immigrants. Now, one came in shortly after the Mayflower. So a long time ago, but the other ones came in the 1800s from Germany, and so I am not anti-immigrant. I am anti-illegal immigrant. I am a big believer in, doing it right. I had to do it right to get my wife here. A lot of paperwork, a lot of waiting. It's frustrating, but you do it right. And then everything pays off. Her parents were refugees. We had to bring them over on refugee visas and then transfer those refugee visas into permanent residence status paperwork. You got to do it. You got to do it right. But when it's done, it's done. I'm not a fan of, illegal immigrants, but here I got to be realistic. How many people go to the supermarket every day? Not every day, but once a week. You know, all those fresh vegetables they got. I mean, it's delicious, man. It's good stuff. Even in the middle of winter, we can buy them. Where do they come from? Places that use illegal Mexican immigration or Hispanic immigration to harvest it. And they've been doing it for decades. It ain't nothing new about it. Why didn't we ever make that a crisis? Because we've been allowing millions of undocumented aliens to come in, harvest our stuff, work in the thing, do the cheap labor. I'm going to be staying in a hotel later this week. Probably some sort of undocumented alien going to be flipping down my sheets at night. And it's been happening for years. Right down here, I know where they go out for the day workers. They did in Poughkeepsie and Kingston, all up and down the New York corridor from New York City here. The guys come out and they bring by their pickup trucks and they count them off, and they pick these guys up, take them out, work, pay them in cash, and they leave. Why? Because it's cheaper than hiring union. These guys are hard workers. They work hard. I also know that there's a whole bunch of problems in the world today, and people are looking to the United States to be the savior. I mean, we have the Statue of Liberty. Give me, you're tired, you're hungry, you're needy, da-da-da-da-da. And so, you know, on the one hand, I'm like, I think everybody should be legal. On the other hand, I'm like, well, God, we've been turning a blind eye to this. Now we're getting bum rushed. And now it's a problem. I mean, literally, it's a problem. Our cities are being overwhelmed. We didn't budget for this. It's problematic. So I am not somebody who's out there saying we got to let them in no matter what. But I'm also someone who says we've been doing it for a long time and only now it's a problem. These people need money. Most of the Chinese that are coming in come from, I don't know, are they coming from China? Are they coming from parts of Asia where there's large Chinese populations? I saw comments that they're all North.
Did you see the 60 minute, the segment that 60 Minutes did a couple of weeks ago?
No.
According to them, they were even interviewing some of these people. They appear to be middle class and maybe even above at times. And they're asking them why they're coming in, and they're saying, you know, for freedom. They're trying to escape repression. I can't say that it's true or not true, but that's what they should.
Well, that's the appropriate answer if you're going to be testifying before a INS judge and all that. Freedom, asylum, freedom.
Right, but by the looks of them too, though, you see, as compared to other very poor migrants who have nothing, or they maybe have a backpack, these people have luggage on rollers.
Well, that's a different. First of all, those aren't the guys flowing in over the border. They're coming.
That's what it was.
The majority of people aren't coming in middle class with suitcases. The majority of people coming in broke, poor.
I agree. But he's not asking about the majority. He's asking about this Chinese thing. Now, did you see the interview with Brett Weinstein? He went to the Darien Gap, which I think is between Panama and Colombia, very rough terrain. And he found a camp with military age, all male Chinese people. And they were hostile. And unlike all the other migrants who will talk to you and tell you what's going on, why they're there, they wouldn't. Let me just show you a clip from that. I just want you to see, this is a bit different. I don't really know what conclusion, but maybe you will have a take on it. Take a look at this.
Is that we went to another camp called San Vicente. And everything in San Vicente is different than it was at Canaan Mambrio. San Vicente, first of all, it's not a town. This is a camp that is built as a transit camp. It's built of containers and various objects to house people. And it is almost entirely Chinese. Now, there were Chinese folks.
Chinese. That's a long way from China.
It sure is. And what's more, in this camp, the rule that you're able to go in and walk around and talk to people is not in evidence. The Cenafront, the Panamanian border control, actually forbid us to go into the camp. Outside of the San Vicente camp, the Chinese migrants are, you can interact with them. There are a couple of shops where they go to buy water or snacks or whatever. And so you can interact with them at those places. They are the opposite of forthcoming. They have no interest in talking to outsiders. And I've been to dangerous places before. I've been to places where people fear their government and can't talk to you because they feel it's not safe. This didn't feel like that at all. This felt like people who did not want to share information because it would be a mistake to do so. So it is not a friendly migration. Chinese folks who are overwhelmingly male, military age. There are women present. I realized only this morning that in thinking back, I saw few, if any, children in the Chinese migration. They were everywhere in the other places we visited, but they were not present, as far as I remember, in the San Vicente camp.
Military age, Jeff, is from 8 to 60. That's every freaking swinging dick in the world, man. So I don't buy into this military age crap. Almost everybody that comes across the border as an adult is military age. Look, I'm not saying there isn't a problem. I am saying this reeks of Sinophobia. It's the same kind of prejudice, just straight up prejudice, that I'm trying to fight with Russia, and I don't like it. I agree they shouldn't be allowed in. I don't believe in massive illegal immigration. I believe that all illegal immigrants should, there should be rules in place, mechanism in place to slow this down, to prevent it. Laws are the laws, but I'm not going to jump on the, oh my God, I'm afraid of China thing. No. Chinese have, you know, everybody who comes to America has their reason. You know, look, some of their reasons could be nefarious. You know, we know that the Mexican cartels bring people across because they're, you know, running drugs and they need to build networks. And so a large number of military aged men come across and they create gangs. We know the gangs come in here to feed off of immigrant populations. We know that the Chinese smuggled in cops to come into the United States to police the Chinese community, you know, to bring Chinese law. They got found in New York City. There's a big case about that. You know, so there's stuff going on that shouldn't be going on. That I agree with. I'm 100% behind strong border control laws, etc. But I'm not jumping on the China is bad bandwagon. I'm just not going to do that. These Chinese, I can tell you that if I were with my white boys trying to get into a Chinese place, and I had Chinese journals around there, I wouldn't talk to them. I'd be a little reticent. Now, I'm military age. Well, actually, I'm 2 years older than military, but my point is, you know, no.
He said military age, but I have a feeling he probably meant, you know, around 20.
It doesn't matter. It's prejudice. Okay. It's prejudice. All right. I hate prejudice.
I just wanted you to know what he was referring to. Let's move on to the next question and get back to our 3-minute limit. Adam Smith in Frankfurt. What will happen to the Arabs in Israel once the Palestinian state is established?
Well, if it's a two-state solution, the Arabs in Israel will live in Israel like they do. If it's a one-state solution, the Arabs will live in Palestine like most Arabs want. That's as simple as it gets.
Oh, I guess that's the end of that question. Let's move on. Hang on a second here. Let me... The next
I guess I should go longer on my answers, huh? If we got to
no, it's the duration is fine. It's just that it's hard sometimes to tell the difference between a pause and the end. That was
for
the
me
end,
too.
Not a,
for me too.
Not
I confused myself.
Carl from the United States of America, one of the top nations in North America. Israel has carried out heavy bombings in Lebanon. Is their plan to terrify and turn the Lebanese people against Hezbollah? It is worth noting that 71% of Israelis support a war on Lebanon.
Well, I think what Israel's trying to do is send a signal to Lebanon that remember 2006. That's what they're trying to do. Remember that the Israelis have the whole, you know, mowing the grass doctrine that dates back to the bombing of West Beirut back in 2006. And the idea for the Israelis is to tell the Lebanese that the price you're going to pay to facilitate Hezbollah continuing to put pressure on us is going to get out of control. We will level you. We will flatten you. And so they're trying to create indirect pressure on Hezbollah to, you know, stop or slow down or withdraw, et cetera. But it's not going to work. You know, it is because first of all, there will be a red line that's crossed, and then Israel knows this too. Israel has to be careful because if Hezbollah decides, screw it, it's a war, then Israel loses the northern Israel. They lose the Galilee. They lose Golan, and they know that they can't stop this. They know it. They know they can't stop this. They know what Hezbollah can do, and they know they're not ready for it. But you know, Israel is in a very difficult situation because they're trying to win this conflict against Hamas and Gaza. They're not going to, but they're trying to. They think they have a winning formula. They think that they can basically get these Palestinians to have nowhere to go but Egypt. And once the Palestinians are out of Gaza, then Israel declares victory. They've won. They've depopulated it. There's still Hamas underground. It's more problematic than that. But this is a simplistic calculation. But as they start to squeeze 1.6 million people in the Rafah camps, Hezbollah is starting to ratchet up the pressure. because Hezbollah said, we're not going to let you defeat Hamas. And so Israel's trying to preempt that by telling the Lebanese, you will pay a heavy price if this happens. But Israel knows that they don't want to bring Hezbollah. So there's this game being played as they run. Look, Israel doesn't care about international opinion anymore. I mean, it's disgusting what they're doing. It's beyond disgusting. Disgusting doesn't even, criminal doesn't even apply. I mean, this is the most, quickly, you know, I wrote Sympathy for the Devil, part one. And it was, you know, basically an introduction, you know, my relationship with the devil. There's a part two. And I've had to hold off writing it because things have happened, like the International Court of Justice ruling, and now what's going on. It's about Israel. Israel is the personification of evil. Israel is the embodiment of the devil. This is the nature of the book, or of the article. And that's what I need to impart here. The concept of evil, pure evil, the kind of evil that dehumanizes a person. This is Israel today. This is the Israeli army. It's the vast majority of the Israeli citizens. They become hate-filled, vile, evil, satanic creatures. Because that's the only way you can describe deliberately bombing civilians, which is what they're doing.
Okay, the next question is from Dave in Olympia, Washington. My friend was the third U.S. soldier to enter Kuwait City in the first Gulf War. He was a Marine. He suffered wounds that altered his life and has struggled to get the care he needs from the VA ever since. Can you speak to how Russia treats their disabled soldiers?
Well, I just want to say, if he's the third U.S. soldier, no, he's the third U.S. Marine. Marines are never soldiers. Just have to correct. But at least you capitalized Marine, Dave. So good job. And I'm sorry for your friend suffering wounds. And I know that the VA can be a challenge. Russians, let me just start off with this. Russians actually support their troops. They don't put yellow stickers on the back of the car, ribbons, you know, support our troops and forget about them. The Russian support. Is there medical care, you know, the best in the world and all that? It's not bad. Wounded Russian soldiers. Let me tell you what happens to them. If you're wounded, you go to retraining, and they have a big retrain, and you get a certificate that you've been retrained. Retraining is two things. Retraining, one is how to get on with your life, how to take care of yourself with the prosthetics and all this. You get that. The second one is, if you can't work in your old job in the military, but you have some functionality, they can retrain you to stay in the military. So you can become a clerk, or you can do something that isn't frontline combat. But if you can't, then they retrain you to be part of society. To get a job, they'll give you a vocation. They retrain you, and you get a certificate, and then that certificate goes out there, and that qualifies you to get jobs. You show up at a job site, and you say, "I'm trained, and here's my Ministry of Defense certificate." Boom, and the job site can't go, "Yeah, sorry, pal." The job site goes, "By law, I got to take you." That's how they take care of these guys. By law, you get a pass, free public transportation. The Russians respect their military. And they're learning to respect them even more now because of the special military operation, because the soldiers are now, you know, they're likening this almost to the Great Patriotic War in terms of the level of patriotism. And so there's a lot more attention being paid because there's going to be a lot more wounded veterans out there. At the end of the Second World War, the veterans from the Great Patriotic War were revered heroes. I mean, these guys walked down the streets and people respected them, and that's the way it's going to be with these guys. In America, we don't respect our soldiers, not the average American. No. I mean, look, I'll tell you this. If I'm at a restaurant and I see Marines in transit wearing the uniform, they don't pay for a thing. They won't know it. But I will go up to the waitress and say their bill comes to me and just tell them thank you for your service from an anonymous American. People in uniform don't pay in front of me. You know, thank God I don't live near a military base. I'd be broke. but no, I mean, because I appreciate their service. Nobody else does, not hardly anybody. Some people, oh, I do. Well, then prove it. Go to a VA and help them change the colostomy bag. Go there on weekends and participate in the roundtable discussions. Help them retrain. Open up your jobs to veterans. No, everything we do here is ad hoc. In Russia, it's formalized, it's policy, and people support it.
Okay. The next question is from Joe in Granada, Spain. Syria is suffering under the Caesar sanctions, which are causing widespread famine and depredation. Why can't Russia help alleviate these problems? Can't Russia send food and supplies to Syria, their friend and ally?
They do. What the hell are you talking about, Joe? They do. Russia sends airplanes full of stuff. Russian soldiers go out to the villages and hand care packages out. Russians work. The military comes in, opens up clinics and helps. But the Syrian government is doing this too. I mean, it's not like the Syrian government's helpless. They're working on it. But the key thing is the economic interaction, get industries up and running. And, you know, Russia can only do so much. But no, Russia's helping with humanitarian goods, and Russia is encouraging other nations to invest in Syria. You're going to see now that BRICS is becoming a thing with, you know, more nations, you're going to see BRICS invest. You're going to see some Chinese investment. So, yeah, I mean, the Caesar sanctions are a pain in the ass. But one of the reasons why people couldn't come in and work in Syria is because of secondary sanctions. Because if you're violating the Caesar sanctions, you get sanctions. But now, basically, the United States is sanctioning everybody. The Russians don't fear secondary sanctions anymore because there's nothing left to sanction. China doesn't give a rat's ass about sanctions. Other nations don't as well. And as you start to create this sanctions-proof world where American sanctions no longer intimidate people, the aid will flow into Syria. It's going to take time because evading sanctions, because that's what it is, or countering sanctions, isn't as simple. But the mechanisms are in place. There's nations that are willing and ready to do this, and Russia will be in a leadership position. Remember, Russia is the chairman of the BRICS forum this year. The big BRICS summit's going to be held in Kazan, the city of Kazan, in October. And you're going to see a lot of institutionalization of efforts to de-dollarize, because by de-dollarizing, you don't touch the dollar. You're not involved with SWIFT. They can't sanction you. You know, the way the U.S. sanctioned you is if you touch a dollar or your dollar touches a bank account, we automatically come in and sanction you, even though what you're doing has nothing to do with us. De-dollarization is sanction proofing, and you're finding that nations will start to interact in ways that the dollar isn't involved, and the U.S. will be powerless, and Syria will get help.
Roger Codger in Northeast Ohio. Tell us about the wicker shelves over your right shoulder, and what happened to the beautiful cabinet that was previously behind you? Why the switch?
The cabinet's still there. I just shifted it because my daughter got a job, and she is in New York City now. We got her an apartment there. She has an apartment. And when she moved out, she left some stuff. And one of the things she's left was this wicker case. And while the background looks like it's organized, I had stacks of crap and books all over the place. So to get to my desk was literally a death march. And my desk was cluttered. So I brought that in to try and bring some organization. So I had to shove the Chinese cabinet over here. It's still there. It's still cool looking, but it's no longer dominant. And I put this in place to hold some of the stuff. It was sitting in the garage. It was doing nothing. And I had a whole bunch of stuff on the ground that needed to be organized, and I went ahead and did it. So I apologize if I've ruined the aesthetics, but it is what it is. Scott does have a nice rug to tie the room together, but those damn nihilists are going to come in and take it or pee on it. I mean, the dogs are nihilists. You know the reference?
No. Explain.
The Great Lebowski.
Oh, okay. I get it. No, I was thinking as soon as I heard your daughter is in New York, it made me wonder how she's coping with the trucker strike. Is she finding no groceries on the shelves?
That's why they came home this weekend and literally took two bags of groceries with them. I'm in favor of this trucker strike. I'm, like I said, I anybody who watched me, I'm not the biggest fan of Trump. I find a lot to be critical of, but I think this witch hunt, I think what they did to him in the New York court is criminal. It's purely a political thing. This attorney general is a disgrace. and the judge is even a bigger disgrace. So, hey, truckers, do it, man. Strangle the life out of the city. Bring it down. Bring the whole state down. Make the governor come begging to the judge to reverse, or put so much political pressure on the appellate court that they say, to save New York, we have to reverse this thing, because this is the most unjust thing in the world. It's purely politics. Purely politics.
Right. I got into it with a few people on X. You may remember, I think it was just a couple of episodes ago, I commented on how I don't like it when protesters bother people who are innocent, you know, like when they block traffic. And so people were saying, hey, what about this? You know, you're just going to harm innocent people. But I think what you said is really what the goal is. It's to put pressure on New Yorkers to demand that their leaders drop the witch hunt.
Yeah, but we're not. It's not. No truckers. I haven't seen the truckers stop anybody from going in. I'd be against that. Mm-hmm. I'd be against that. Don't. No, come on into New York. We're just not going. We're not going. You can go to New York. Fact is, the more people that go to New York City, the better. We'd love it nothing more than 50 million people go to restaurants and start ordering food, and then the restaurants run out of food, and they don't have any food left to feed the people, and now everybody's hungry, and they say, we'll never go to New York City again, and New York City becomes a ghost town. And when it becomes a ghost town, they get no tax revenue, which is what feeds New York State. They do all the stuff in New York State that keeps Kathy Hochul in office, and then she collapsed, and government collapsed, and New York State collapsed. And yes, that's what needs to happen, because what they did to Donald Trump, and again, I am not a Donald Trump fan, but what they did was wrong. This was the politicization of the courts.
Absolutely. Yeah. You don't have to like Donald Trump to realize that what they're doing to him is obscene. That was the word Jonathan Turley used. He wrote a great column somewhere or other, I think maybe The Hill. And it's obscene, the amount of money that they want. He's got to pay like millions of dollars just to file an appeal.
No, this is a huge trap. I mean, and the interest rate. No, this is, it's criminal what they're doing. It's purely criminal. He needs an injunction. Again, I'm not a lawyer, but I mean, there's basically, this has got to go to someplace. The governor has to step in and say, no.
Yeah, I don't really know what the solution is, but maybe if I don't even know if this boycott is real. I mean, they could be just making a lot of noise and there's not that many truckers.
Yeah, I actually think there's going to be enough truckers that say, I need the paycheck and I'm going to deliver and it's not going to work. And Trump, look, who knows what's going to happen? This, I can't even say that I want Trump to be president. I know I don't want Biden to be president, but I can't sit here and say, oh, I can't wait for Donald Trump, because there's a lot of baggage there. I love his stance on NATO. I hate his stance on Israel. I'm afraid he'd get us in a war with Iran. But if he wants to tear down these
But he's the vehicle to fight this police state, this lawfare that they're doing.
I think so. I think the idea of the best thing that came out of Donald Trump's mouth in a long time was when he said, I'm going to fire every civil servant that it doesn't take an oath of loyalty. People, well, you can't do that. Yes, you can. You know what happens as soon as the president comes in? He expects letters of resignation from everybody, because he's the new man. He's the man in charge. Now, if he likes you, he says, no, you get to stay. You get to stay. You get to stay. But to be honest, after what happened to Trump last time, where everybody stabbed him in the back, I would basically say, you were appointed by Biden. You're out. You're out. You're out. Yeah, I'm sorry. You're out. I'm bringing in my people. So that when I say, I'd like to do the following, I have people to say, we'll work with you, boss. I tell the story about when I was at the reunion of the INF treaty, and somebody asked this this Secretary of State for Arms Control, why didn't Biden implement his promise to have single use or sole purpose doctrine for nuclear weapons? I mean, the sole purpose is deterrence, that we will not do preemption and all this kind of stuff. Biden ran on that. That was part of his platform. And yet now he's president and he just published a national security strategy that said, no, we're going to stick with preemption. So the question was asked. I wish I asked it, but I didn't. How did this happen? Isn't he commander in chief? The answer was, literally, the interagency wasn't ready for this. Well, who the hell voted for the interagency? The American people didn't. Whether you support the outcome of the 2020 election or not, Biden's name was on the ballot. People voted for him. And according to enough, the law, enough people voted for him that he got enough electoral college votes, they became president of the United States. There's people that contest that. That's a different issue. but he now is the president of the United States. The president says he wants something to happen, whether you agree with it or not. He said he wanted it to happen. And the interagency that none of us voted for, we don't even know how to define it, said, no, we're not ready. All you people who think you live in a democracy, you don't. You don't live in a democracy, because a democracy doesn't work that way. And so when Trump says, you know, when I become president, I want my policies to be enacted. I want, you know, it's not a dictatorship. There's still laws on the book, but you need people that will support you. You don't need people to sabotage you from within, the deep state, to, you know, I'll take this piece of paper, put it at my desk, and I'll just conveniently forget about it for the next 6 months as I slow roll this thing to death. People who have helped shape the rules, and they know the laws, they know timelines, and they know just how to stall things and not make it happen. You don't want those people in government. That's not the purpose. The purpose of government is to get things done. And you elect a president who says, I want to do X, Y, and Z. If you don't want him to do X, Y, and Z, vote for the other guy. But if he becomes president, he gets to do X, Y, and Z, as long as it doesn't violate the Constitution or the law. But we have this interagency that blocks him. And I love that Trump says he's going to clean that up. That would be a big thing. Getting out of NATO would be a big thing. And then we just have to see about the rest of the stuff. I mean,
All right, two things real quick. One of the commenters asked, would either Scott or I ever vote for a Green Party candidate? No, not this time around. Trump, because as I said, he is the vehicle to fight what we've just been talking about. If he isn't put back in the White House, then the situation we've been discussing has wins. It's just going to perpetuate. And it's got to be fought. So I.
Well, the other thing too is a Green Party candidate would get killed by the deep state.
Yep.
Let's just say hypothetically speaking, I don't know, is Cornel West Green Party or is he independent? What is he now?
I don't remember, but yeah, it's not going to happen anyway.
Let's just say Cornel gets voted in as president. Mm-hmm. You do understand that not a single policy will get done. Nothing he wants. He will be paralyzed in Congress because he doesn't have a congressional constituency. Again, you can condemn Trump all you want. You can say, I hate MAGA Republicans. That's fine. I applaud you for believing what you believe in. But understand that if he gets elected, it's because you have a constituency of MAGA Republicans who are now in a position to support him. Just like Biden has a constituency of, you know, Democrats who are in a position to support him. Things can get done. But if a Green Party person gets in and they don't have a backing in the Congress, nothing gets done. Literally nothing gets done. And the deep state will slow roll it to death anyway. So, you know, the best thing I don't know. America's so fundamentally broken right now. I don't know if there's a best thing. We're talking about the worst, the least worst option right now.
Well, the other thing I was starting to say, Scott, is that it's now 4 o'clock and we've departed from our format today. So if you have the time and the willingness, I propose that we extend to at least 4:15. Are you up for
4:15
that?
4:15 is doable. 4:30 is not doable, but 4:15 is doable.
Let's get back to it and try to get some more questions in and answers to those questions. You remember Phil. This is Phil from London.
Oh, Phil. Hi, Phil. I'm in a good mood today, Phil, so it's not a big problem. No,
we'll see how many times you say his name. Currently, the USA uses war, coups, economic pressure, bribery, blackmail, and U.S. aid as the basic instruments of its foreign policy. In an ideal world, what strategies and principles should guide U.S. foreign policy? What, in your opinion, is the USA's legitimate sphere of influence?
Legitimate sphere of influence is that which protects the American people from harm. So I would say that if there's a threat in the world that is capable of manifesting itself in physical harm to the American people, that's in my sphere of influence, interest, where I have a right to impose my will on that to prevent this harm from happening. But then you have to temper everything, because let's say there's somebody out there that's doing something that I don't like China out there doing Belt and Roads Initiative. I don't like it. China's getting these business deals. We're not. I don't get, you know, I'm not going to support, you know, using covert action and all this stuff to tear down China. I would say we have to learn to compete better with China. co-opt the Chinese. Diplomacy is the big thing. I would start using businessmen as ambassadors, not to be a front for the CIA and covert operations, but to go in and listen to people and talk to people. If we have values that are worthy of emulation, then let's send out ambassadors of these values and let the values sell themselves and sell America the through hard work by showing that we work harder and we have better outcomes than you. It takes a lot of work. What all those things that you listed are designed to prevent other people from having a say, that we're going to come in and we're going to bend you to our will. I don't think that America should be in the business of bending people to our will. I think if we build a good enough product here at home, if we have a democracy that functions, that works, that's fair, where we haven't politicized the courts, and where we're not going to war against everybody in the world, where our economy is benefiting the American people, and it's a good economy that has good basic economic principles instead of $33 trillion in debt, that the world's going to sit there and go, that's a pretty good model. Hey, China, we're going with them. We're going with those guys. That's what I would, in the ideal world. But we have to stop saying that or acting in a way that says, if you don't support us, then we're going to destroy you. Because that's what all those things you talked about, sanctions, blackmail, et cetera, military, it's about destroying people that don't agree with us. And again, if you exist for the sole purpose of bringing harm to America and the American people, then I get to kill you. I'm sorry. And I'm America. I'm big. I will beat the living snot out of you. I will crush you like you've never been crushed before, because that's called deterrence too. I want people to know that I don't want to fight. I'm willing to work with you, and I'm going to allow you to beat me in all this stuff. You beat me economically, hey, I got to do better. If you beat me diplomatically, I got to do better. But you will never beat me militarily. I will kill you. I will destroy you. I will destroy your entire family. I will wipe you off the face of the earth. Don't try it. I'm for that, but I'm not for, if you don't do what I tell you to do, the military's coming in. That's not right.
All right. Well, it's good to see that you and Phil have made up. Maybe we can all share a summer home together this year and drink to the good old days.
All right.
Phil. The next question is from Constantine in Romania. How much longer can Hamas survive the war? They can't get their food, medicine, and weapons given the total siege. Is this what Netanyahu is relying on?
I mean, in short, yes. But let me just remind you, Constantine, that Hamas, hey, grape in time, you will genocide me? Try it, pal. I know you're joking, but no, it ain't going to happen. I know I'm an ugly American, but we don't lose. I don't lose. You want to fight? I will kill you. Anyways, now I go back to being nice, Scott. Hamas has spent decades building covert lines of supply. They have tunnels going into Egypt that nobody knows about. And I think basically they are getting the supplies. Plus, they've built up a nice war chest. That they're not in the business of taking care of 1.6 million Palestinian people. I mean, it's sad, but they're in the business of maintaining a viable combat force, which they have done. Is there a limit? There's always a limit. Logistics is the thing that makes military operations possible. And if you can starve Hamas of ammunition, look at what's happening with Ukraine right now. No ammunition, no fuel, no nothing. They're getting their butts kicked. If you create that situation where Hamas has run out of ammunition, run out of food, run out of fuel, and they can't continue to resist, then you've beat them. But I don't think we're there yet. I think Hamas has planned for this. They stockpiled large amounts of material. I would bet throughout Sinai, there are warehouses with stuff, and those warehouses are being emptied, going into tunnels that are making it into Hamas. And then there's other networks that bring this stuff in, including weapons and ammunition. I think the Iranians had set up something a long time ago that to get that stuff in there. How do you think all that stuff got in there? Israel controls everything. Egypt blocks the borders. How did Hamas get all this modern weaponry? Same way they're getting it now. And so I think Hamas has a lifeline that's sustainable, and therefore they're not going to be beaten.
Valaja in Paris Island, or on Paris Island, Tucker asked Putin if he would attack Poland, and he said no. What if F-16s take off from Polish airfields and attack Russian troops? Would he then strike them? Should he have answered differently?
But he did answer differently, Volodya. He said, he didn't say no. He said the only way we would attack Poland is if Poland attacked us first. That's what he said. And the scenario you just outlined has Poland attacking Russia first by allowing Ukrainian F-16s to take off from Polish airfields. It's an act of war. So we know what Russia would do. Putin has answered that question. Those airfields will cease to exist. So question asked, question answered.
Sloika from the great state of Connecticut. A Russian general has accused the Ukrainian air. What? You didn't say what?
The great state. Where'd you get that?
Oh, I don't know. I guess I was just imagining it.
Okay.
Sloika from the Nutmeg State, the Constitution State of Connecticut. A Russian general has accused the Ukrainian Air Force of using chemical weapons supplied by the U.S. Why do we have these in stock if there are treaties against them? And could there be any repercussions to the USA?
Well, first of all, chemical weapons is sort of a broad-based thing. A smoke round is a chemical weapon. Tear gas is a chemical weapon. White phosphorus is a chemical weapon. So, you know, you have to be careful. There's you know, lethal chemical weapons that are on the, you know, the prohibited list for the OPCW, sarin nerve agent, Tabun, Novichok, the most lethal chemical agent in the world that has never killed the people it's supposed to kill. But remember Navalny, Novichok, didn't kill him. Skripals, didn't kill them either. But it's the most dangerous substance known to man. But the point is, I'd have to know exactly what they're accusing the Ukrainians of using. What I'll say is this, that the United States has officially complied with the chemical weapons treaty convention, and we've disarmed ourselves of chemical weapons agent, the stockpiles, and we don't have on hand supplies of bombs. So it's not like there's, you know, we say, hey, give them a lot A out of warehouse B, send it over there. No. So I think, you know, there's a broad usage of chemical weapons. I'd be interested if they were using some sort of tear gas or incapacitating gas that isn't illegal. It's not prohibited. There's restrictions on how it can be used, and maybe they're using it the wrong way. But I need to know more detail about the accusation that the Russian generals put out there.
Okay, Old Blind Jim, we're just about out of time. Can you make it short?
Yes, sir.
Okay, go.
That was very short.
Okay. All righty. Look, holy script, holy. This is what the Novichok is going on. Treason is the reason. And I was born in the United States of America. I now live in the United States of apartheid, which has no bounds on race, creed, color, or gender. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Old Blind Jim. Well, we squeezed him in. Let's do the coin giveaway, and then we'll call it a show. The winner will get their choice of one of the following two coins. This is the coin that Scott gave away when he went to Russia last May, and this is the one he gave away when he went there in January. And
while we're waiting for the numbers to build up, we'll roll it at 700 if we can get people interested. Come on, people. Detuned asked the question, says, Scott, you did 180 supporting Israel. Could you ever change your mind on 9/11 conspiracy? Maybe have a discussion with Ryan Dawson. Hey, Detune, let me just put it this way. I got Ryan Dawson on speed dial. I've had many discussions with Ryan. Ryan and I communicate on a regular basis. I am an open-minded person. Ryan Dawson has provided me with every chart he's ever made in his life. I am willing to have a discussion with anybody and everybody, especially somebody like Ryan Dawson, who doesn't dictate. He talks. We engage in a conversation. And so I talked to Ryan. Look, if Ryan ever puts the data on the table that makes my poor little pathetic Marine brain go click, 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 I can change. But until my brain clicks out of where I've been clicked in, no, I stick to my principles. So that's it. We got 9 more to go, 6 more to go. Yeah.
We were both mocked today on X by somebody who was laughing at us because we believed the official story of 9/11. And I said, well, I never said I believe it. I just said that the 9/11 kooks make no sense.
Jeff,
there's a difference. There's a difference. Okay, 700. So let's do the drawing right now and see who will win the coin.
Maybe Rumble will get it today. Maybe Rumble.
Maybe.
Rumble. YouTube. Okay.
Jorge.
All right, Jorge. Good job. We'll give it to you.
Congratulations to Jorge Salida or Saldias. Send us an email, info@ustourofduty.com. Let us know which of the two coins you want and give us your address so we can actually get it to you. Thanks to Yelena for her backstage assistance. Thanks to our beloved audience, as always. Thanks to our beloved weapons inspector. I hope the audience feels we made it up to you. We gabbed more than usual, but we made it up to you by, I hope you agree, by extending.
And we gave
him
an article, a great article.
Indeed, we did. And part two, the goal is to have part two published by Friday's show so that we can talk about it then. We may also have Julian Assange news by then, today and tomorrow. There's what might be, or I think probably is, the last hearing that it's either going to be good news or bad news in England. So perhaps we'll have something to say about that as well.
But I'm not writing an article before Friday. I'm only going to do one article for Friday.
One article. All right. I didn't say you write an article. I said we may talk about it.
I know, but what happens every time there's big news, suddenly people are like, oh, you got to do this, that, and the other. I'm like, I'm still dealing with the Navalny thing.
I know. And often with like no empathy at all for what the writer has to go through. They want something. They're like, hey, I want you to, you know, it's like they give you an assignment. Write this for me. You know, yeah, address this.
My wife was funny because last night, you know, I told you because Jeff and I had a conference call yesterday dealing with the movie. But I told him that I wanted to get him the article before the conference call. Then the conference call comes and he's like, I'm like, Jeff, it's not ready. He's like, no kidding. And I said, but I'm going to get it to you tonight. As soon as I hung up with the conference call, I got back into it. And damn it, I found Navalny's live journal. I found the journal, the actual journal that he blogged on. And I went, holy shit, I got to read all this. And so now I have to read this source. And then in there, he's mentioning things. I'm like, God, I got to go research that too. Cause I'm very thorough. I mean, I try to make, when I say there's a relationship and all that, it's not shallow. And suddenly next thing I know, it's 2 a.m. and Marina's like, hey, are you coming to bed? I'm like, I can't. Jeff needs the article. I gotta finish. But I ended up going face down and woke up, and the entire, like, I think I had 3 pages of like X's because my finger hit a key and I'm down asleep. And I went, I guess I got to go to bed. So
that's a sign. That's definitely. Did you see somebody? I don't know if it's reliable or not. Somebody sent me some medical information about it.
I saw that. It's going to be incorporated into this thing.
Oh, good.
Because the whole Novichok thing is a fraud. There was never any Novichok. It's manufactured up, and that goes back to, you know, Frankie Five Angels and what happened. So.
All right. And I mispronounced his name at the beginning. I suddenly had a case of dyslexia. It's Navalny.
Navalny.
Hopefully that was only temporary dyslexia. We'll see. All right. Take care, everybody. We'll see you on Friday night at 8 p.m. Eastern time.